WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, James Carville fights back. The chief strategist for Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign says Democrats need to be on the offensive. His new book is We're Right, They're Wrong, A Handbook for Spirited Progressives. Also, on November 11, 1994, a teenager in Philadelphia was killed in a savage attack by a group of rival high school kids. Eddie Pollack was brutally clubbed with baseball bats. One of the young men who attacked Eddie pled guilty and was sentenced this week. We'll talk with a journalist who covered the story and with Eddie Pollack's parents. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. There is nothing subtle about James Carville. He has made his reputation for being a hard-nosed, high-strung, and gifted campaign strategist for the Democratic Party. He was an important player in Bill Clinton's run for the presidency, providing focus, battlefield tactics, and a lot of Louisiana grit and charm. He's also famous for his marriage to his counterpart in the 1992 presidential race, Mary Madeline, who was a strategist for President Bush's reelection campaign. They married shortly after Clinton's victory and have since co-authored a book, All's Fair, and had a baby named Maddie. James Carville has just come out with his own book, a manifesto for Democrats called We're Right, They're Wrong. He says it's time for progressives to be more outspoken. Problem is, as he tells it, too many Democrats are, quote, a bunch of well-meaning weenies. I asked Carville when the Democrats became such pushovers.
Well, I think it sort of built up and it sort of culminated after the 1994 elections. And we just wouldn't fight back. We started, I think, doubting ourselves, and we became resigned at one point to just letting Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh and Jesse Helms and Pat Robinson of the world, letting these people just dominate the dialogue. And I noticed that we just were sort of accepting some of their premises, at least not challenging them. I'm sure we wasn't accepting them, but we were weenies.
So did you write this book to give ammunition to those nervous, tongue-tied Democrats?
Yes, that was certainly, I would say that was one of the big reasons that I did. And to also try to get back into this insane dialogue that we have in this country, that the federal government, a government has never done anything right since it's been founded, I mean, which is absolutely goofy. It's asinine. And I don't know why we have to accept that. We don't. We ought to look back and see where the government has gone right and continue these things. And where it's gone wrong, either get rid of it or fix it or make it better.
You said in your book that the federal government has played an important role in your life, and that's even before you started running Democrats' political campaigns, but talking about your schooling and the military and other issues as well. And at issue today is a discussion, an argument, a debate about the proper role of the federal government. Mm-hmm. Do you have some sense about where, generally speaking, where you think the federal government does the best job and where you think state governments can really come in and do a better job?
Well, I mean, look, there are places where the state government can come in and do a better job, appropriate, probably, unless there's places that probably, people can come in and do a heck of a job. What I'm saying is that the Republican Party, not all of them, but the current crowd has said everything that the federal government touches, turns to crap. It has never accomplished anything. One of my favorite statistics is since 1965 in this country, the federal government has spent half of its money on national defense, Social Security, and Medicare. We won the Cold War. In 1965, the elderly rate among poverty was 27%. Today it is 11%. That is a major societal achievement. America ought to take a victory lap. By more than half, we've reduced the ratio of elderly people who go to bed cold and hungry. I feel good about that. Do you know what the only positive health statistic the United States leads the world in, the only one? It's life expectancy after 65. That is a result of but one thing, Medicare. We have an absolutely first-class, successful way we deliver health care to our elderly. The point is that the media does not, if no one knows this. This is not something that you're supposed to tell people. And certainly the Republicans don't want to know that there's been any government success stories. Do you know what percent of the adults smoked in 1965? About 45. You know what it is today? About 25. Why did that happen? Because the federal government and the Surgeon General said, hey, folks, cut this out. You're killing yourself with that. And we've been pretty successful. Do you know what the environment was like in 1970? And you know what it's like today? You know how much cleaner the water is? How much cleaner the air is? It's immeasurably better. And the reason it did is because of the federal government, because of the EPA. And, look. If the Ebola virus breaks out in your neighborhood, who are you going to call? The health commissioner of the state of Mississippi? You're going to call the CDC? Of course you're going to call the CDC. Who beat the mafia? I mean, we have to come back and understand. When I grew up, I'm 51 years old. When I grew up, black people didn't have anything close to the same rights as white people did. Who do you think got these rights from? The state of Louisiana? Of course not. And what we need to do is we need to discern where we've been successful, what things have worked, and we need to keep those things. And the things that don't work as well, then we need to either make them better or jettison. But what the Republicans say is there's nothing that the government has ever done that's been right. And that's poppycock. And we need to start saying that. We need to quit taking that kind of junk.
But what about your own president, the President of the United States? Do you think that he has really been the kind of articulate champion for the proper role and place of government? I don't hear coming out of his mouth the same kind of passion I hear coming out of yours.
Well, certainly I think he does, and I think a lot of things, I think his record is right there. And one of the things people confuse is they say, well, the president said the era of big government is over. I don't care how big the government is. I'm proud that this president has the fewest federal employees since any president since President Kennedy, reduced by 200,000. People say that President Clinton doesn't keep his promises. You're right, he didn't. He promised to reduce the federal workforce by 100,000, and he did by 200,000. But what he has done is, I think he's done an excellent job of defending those things that work, and has certainly been a 565 Democrat, and that he's been very insistent that there be no cuts in education, job training, and things like that, and has fought against the excessive cuts that the Republicans have offered in Medicare. So I think President's done a real good job. But the other thing is opposed to, I would like to see him shored up by progressives and people who believe in the 565 philosophy as much as he's attacked by the people on the right. And if we had that, we could have a lot more balance.
So how much is the White House enjoying the Republican primary?
Well, I don't know. Everybody in Washington's watching it. I said this morning, this thing reminds me of an old movie about, you know, the nuclear war, nuclear winter. I mean, where everybody's sitting around waiting to see which cockroach survives and comes out. But watch out, because who does will probably be strong, and we can't rest on any laurels or anything here. It's going to be a tough re-election campaign. But certainly it shows that there's confusion in the Republican Party, and all of the issues have not been settled over there. And if anything, it sure is fun watching them flush it out, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, is there any pleasure that you get just watching a party kind of chew on its own leg?
You know, I have this theory that there's probably 600 people in and around Washington that work or cover part of sort of national politics. And I have never seen what I call a gang of 600 so consumed by anything as they are by this. I mean, it's just a fascinating thing to watch. And I watch C-SPAN and say, gee, look at this. And, you know, generally, the whole political community and the journalistic community, we all kind of know who's going to win because we don't know the polls. And even on election day, you know, we get the exit polls and everything. But we don't know anymore. I mean, we have to sit up late at night and wait for the election returns to come in. And it's different. It's fun. And just as somebody who's interested in politics, it's a hell of a show.
Well, I don't know how much free advice you give out to adversaries, but Dole certainly has the support of the party elders. He's certainly a seasoned campaigner. This is probably his last run for the presidency. Why can't he get his campaign jump-started?
Well, because he's got some pretty skilled people running against him. I mean, you know, Buchanan, for what I would consider a multitude of faults and sins, is a pretty skilled communicator. And Bob Dole is not. Bob Dole is running against two people who can explain what they're for in 30 seconds, and Senator Dole has trouble explaining what he's for in 30 minutes. And he's not. I think that, like a lot of times, and it's happened to me before, when you get a kind of front-running thing and you got all these different people that you've put together, it's hard to be nimble afoot and to move around as quickly as you need to. And he's having a little trouble doing that. Now, if you ask me, if you put a gun to my head, which thank God you won't do, you can't, I think he'll probably, you know, be that sort of fictional cockroach that emerges from the, you know, that emerges from all of this. But he's going to have to survive. It's going to be a lot harder on him than I thought.
Well, Pat Buchanan certainly looks like the only one who is enjoying himself on the campaign trail. If you close your eyes, do you hear a Democratic populist?
What I hear is among a whole lot of things, I hear, you know, a part of his message having a correct diagnosis. I hear awful cures. Okay? I mean, basically, it would be like if you went to the doctor and he correctly diagnosed you and you had bursitis and he prescribed arsenic, okay, to get rid of the bursitis. That's the analogy I draw. But I certainly do see that the diagnosis that stagnant wages is a problem is certainly that. Look, there are two overwhelming problems in this country. One is stagnant wages, and two, Democrats better get used to this, is the fact that we have too many children that grow up in non-traditional two-parent families. And we better start talking about it, and start talking about it quickly.
When you hear Patrick Buchanan, do you hear your own Louisianan Huey Long?
No. I mean, there's certainly, you see a lot of traditions that he's in a tradition of Huey Long. He's in a tradition of, you know, some of the old sort of Southern populace. I mean, certainly the kind of railing against the corporations is reminiscent of some of the things that the Long says. But remember, the one thing about the Longs, and people have to understand this to the extent that they were very courageous people. They never, given the times that they lived in and judged by the sort of times, is they were very, very seldom, if ever, played the race card. And Buchanan certainly flirts with it on any sort of number of issues. So I think we've got to be very careful in kind of comparing Buchanan to the Longs. To some extent, it's a lot of things that I could criticize the Longs for, but deep down inside, I guess I would count me, in particularly of Earl, as an admirer.
James Carville is my guest, and he is a Democratic political strategist and the author of a new book with the very subtle title, We're Right, They're Wrong. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is political strategist James Carville, and his latest book is called We're Right, They're Wrong. As you said, this particular primary is really up for grabs, and what it seems to point to is eroding party loyalty. I mean, we're looking at the Republicans, but I wonder whether it's true on the Democratic side. And what's wrong with the parties? Why haven't they been able to keep people identified, closely associated, feeling loyal to a party?
Well, they've got two things. Let's remember this. There's a decline in institutional trust across the board. I mean, that's like asking the churches why they can't keep people, you know, as members. I mean, you're seeing these mainline churches are losing members. There's lack of faith in corporations. There's lack of faith in labor unions. There's lack of faith in civic organizations in the United Way. There's no group in America that's taken a bigger hit than the media has taken. So there's an across-the-board lack of faith in institutional trust. I believe that these are a result of a 30 years of stagnant decline in wages where people feel like that they're working hard and earning less and people at the top have let them down. And two, that they see a deterioration of the traditional American family, and they see people in Washington, and particularly Democrats, often goofy, esoteric discussions about things instead of saying that there's really, if you can, the best way to raise a child is with a mom and daddy at home. And I think we need to start speaking to people in that kind of language, directly, forceful, non-demagogic, or anything like that. And the best way to get a job that pays more is to learn more. And government is going to help you and play a part in you learning more to give you the tools that you need. We're not earning less because people want to immigrate to this country. We're not learning less by blaming other people. We need to earn more by learning more. And that is a good political philosophy, and it's one that we ought to espouse. And we ought to quit telling people, as liberals did in the 70s, that it didn't matter if you didn't have a father at home, that one parent could raise a child as easy as two. Get off of it. It's wrong. All of the research has proved that wrong. It's over.
but can the federal government play a role in people's marriages and keeping people together or getting them to fall in love?
One thing you can do is you can do what we've done on cigarettes, is you can tell people the risk, and you can certainly talk about it. No, I don't think, and I don't agree that you ought to have, make divorce harder for people, but you can certainly tell people what the consequences are. And we can stop telling people what liberals told them in the 70s, that it didn't matter. It does matter. Now, I understand it. Things don't work out, and be the first person to understand that, but we can certainly change the dialogue. We can certainly give two-parent families tools. I mean, we can look through the tax laws to see if there's things that we can do to help people. This child credit might be a something that we need to look at if we can afford it. I certainly would support education credits for tuition and things like that transcend to investments, of which the president does, by the way. I mean, these are the kinds of things that we can do. But no, I don't think the government ought to say you can't split up. That'd be ridiculous. I mean, you couldn't enforce it. But we Democrats need to get away from this mythology that it doesn't matter. It does. And it matters big time.
I'm talking to James Carville, the Democratic political campaign strategist and author of a new book called We're Right, They're Wrong, A Handbook for Spirited Progressives. When is the president going to officially start campaigning?
Well, I guess right now, I mean, the Republicans are creating all the political news. And you have the Republican primaries when they over, and you got a kind of a weird, this is the Olympics are going to be here in the United States, which is going to be a pretty big event. And they're going to be in July. I mean, I suspect he'll kick off his campaign, sometimes in the late spring in terms of announcing and that type of thing. But generally, incumbents, and I think the president's, the economy I see today is starting to pick up some, which is sort of good news for him. But He's got, you know, it's Cuban, Bosnia. He's got some things to do as president, and there'll be plenty of time to get this thing kicked up and going.
Is it a different kind of mindset, a different kind of planning session when you're talking about an incumbent versus someone, obviously, 4 years ago, someone from the outside wanting to be president?
Yeah, I mean, and really, the campaigns for incumbents have to be and should be and ought to be run out of the White House. And it's a different mindset, and it's not really the son of James Carville and, you know, going around some, you know, papers in his back pocket and, you know, figuring this out and, you know, doing that. It's a lot more ordered structure. But it's one that I'm, you know, glad to play, you know, play a role in and do what I can and get my shoulder to the wheel and help the president get reelected.
Do presidents necessarily, or do you think they should run less negative campaigns because it seems more presidential to be positive?
Well, I think what the president needs to do is, A, lay out his record and talk about the things that are up that are supposed to be up, and that's a number of jobs, that's test scores for kids, that's a number of people that we get caught because of Brady Bill, number 44,000 felons caught, and the things that are supposed to be down are down. That's the crime rate, the inflation rate, the unemployment rate, and those things. What I don't think that we need to do is, I think that when we are attacked unjustly, or when the right-wing myth machine comes out, I think we ought to be very aggressive. And I also think that it is not negative to contrast yourself, to talk about what you stand for as opposed to what they stand for. I think the other thing is, I think all of this national, and I say national, but in Washington, is obsessive whining about sort of negativity. Fight it back with facts. And when you fight back with facts in a democracy, that's fighting fair. And every time that if Newt Gingrich sticks his head up and blames me unjustly for Susan Smith's murders, then I'm going to stand up and blame him justly for what he did in his own life. And that's just fighting back, and I have had enough, and I urge other people to not take it anymore.
And would you, under those circumstances, then want the president, say it were, you know, the time were slightly different, really to stand up and say, well, Newt Gingrich...
No, I want the president to say, James, you go out there and do it.
Okay. So you're well, that's what I want to know. What role are you going to play?
Well,
are you their pit bull?
I hope so. That's the role I want, if he lets me. You know what I mean? That's the role I'm going to ask for. Yes, I would like to be the person in the campaign that points out the facts. I would like to be the factual coordinator for this campaign to make sure that the people have the right facts and not Republican myths.
Let me ask you something else about what you do during a campaign, because I read that you have certain superstitions. and I would think for a lot of people in your position that superstitions would be a very handy way to deal with the kind of anxiety of an election, certainly election day when, you know, there's nothing
right.
else you can do.
Yeah, I think you're very astute. You should have been a psychologist. And I think in most campaign people, it's funny, there's one trait that most of us have is we become absolutely obsessed with routine. And if you don't get the same thing or something is closed that you used, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's part of your routine. You become unglued because it's so chaotic and so different every day. The campaign is that... It any change from your sort of routine when you have one becomes very disturbing. One of the I remember is during the debates, during the campaign, we had to go, George and I stayed at the headquarters most of the time. And
George Stephanopoulos.
Right. And so we flew on a plane, and they had to make room for us on the plane. But when they did that, yeah, everybody else had to kind of move, so other people had to move around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some people became so, like, I don't have my regular seat. You know, what's going because you have 10 seats, and so two people shift everything around. And people became so, and I understood that. And I didn't like being on the road because I was used to, you know, eating lunch at the same place and, you know, getting up at the same time and having the same thing for breakfast. And just that, it in one sense, it is. It's almost a obsessive love of routine, but you're mm-hmm. right. You have to have some sort of order and stability. And if I didn't get a chance to run every day at 6:30, 7 o'clock, I forget what time it was, and that was I guess it was 7. I'd go out and run every day. And if something happened and I couldn't do that, you know, they said, "Well, the governor's calling in for a conference call today at 7." It just ruined my whole day. God damn, why can't he call in? You know what I mean? Some other time. I mean, I got to run at 7.
Well, James Carville, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
That's political strategist James Carville. His book is called We're Right, They're Wrong. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On November 11, 1994, the life that Kathy and John Pollock knew changed forever. Their teenage son, Eddie, was brutally beaten by a group of rival high school students. He later died. The story of Eddie's death received national attention because of the poor response by 911 operators. Coming up, we talk with a journalist who covered the story and subsequent trial, and with Kathy and John Pollock, Eddie's parents. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, in for Terry Gross. One of the events that has riveted and outraged people living in the Philadelphia area was the murder of a 16-year-old named Eddie Pollock, who lived in the Fox Chase section of the city. On November 11, 1994, he was attacked and beaten by a mob of teenagers wielding baseball bats who lived in Abington, a suburb of Philadelphia. He died the next day from those injuries. The tardy response of the 911 emergency system that night became national news and was the focus of an investigation. The arrest and trial of the seven suburban youths remained front-page news locally for months. Earlier this week, one of the teenagers who had pled guilty to third-degree murder and had testified for the prosecution was sentenced to 5 to 20 years in prison. The remaining defendants will be sentenced in March. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from Eddie Pollack's parents. But first, let's turn to Bryn Friedman, who covered this story for the Fox 10 o'clock news in Philadelphia. I asked her to take us back to November 11th and tell us what this mob of suburban teens was looking to do.
They're looking for a fight, but the fight actually started the preceding Friday. On Friday, November 4th of 1994, there was an incident at a McDonald's, an incident that never involved Eddie Pollack, but it involved a couple of kids from Fox Chase, girls in a car who came over and got into some kind of altercation with a bunch of guys at Fox Chase who were rocking their cars, threw a soda in their car, apparently swore at them. The girls drove off, went back to Abington, and apparently the rumors began. There was a rumor, a completely unconfirmed rumor, of rape. There was a rumor of the truth of these girls being offended by these guys. And essentially what happened was a group of kids in the Abington High School system and the surrounding area began to plan a fight. They then told the kids in Fox Chase, or some kids in Fox Chase, that the following Friday night, 1 week later, they would be back for the fight.
So where did they go when they got to Fox Chase? Where did they drive to?
They drove to the McDonald's at Fox. Well, they parked apparently in the Pizza Hut parking lot and then ran across through the McDonald's parking lot, according to the testimony from the trial.
And who was at the parking lot there in McDonald's?
Well, in the parking lot at McDonald's, there were any, depends on who you talk to, but there was anywhere from 20 to 50 Fox Chase kids, and there was about 24 kids from Abington. According to some of the testimony, a number of those kids were carrying bats, and the Fox Chase kids took off, running through a place called McGarrity's Auto, screaming, "They have bats, they have bats." According to the Fox Chase kids who testified in court, some of them were expecting a fight, but they were expecting a fist fight. They were not expecting kids to come with bats. When they saw that, they took off, ran down the railroad tracks. Unfortunately, at the McGarrity's Auto Body Stop, a couple of kids actually started to get hit with bats.
Well, where was then Eddie Pollack as these teenagers came in, parked at the McDonald's parking lot? The kids that were there took off screaming, "They've got bats." Where was Eddie Pollack?
Well, Eddie Pollack was in a couple of different places. The things that we know about Eddie Pollack that night, and the worst possible thing that the defense attorneys could come up with, was that Eddie Pollack had bought a keg of beer and was selling cups of beer to people. The defense tried to make this out to be, it was a pre-fight keg party, and Eddie Pollack was sort of agitating these kids. That never came really out in the testimony. What did come out was that Eddie Pollack was a fun-loving kid. He did buy a keg along with another kid. They were selling cups of beer, but that he didn't apparently know anything about this fight and really had nothing to do with it. At one point, he was standing on the train tracks talking to somebody else, and later left, was in the church parking lot when he heard kids coming by him and saying, "There's a fight, these kids are coming, you need to get out of here." And he said, "No, I need to wait for my brother Billy." And that is apparently what led to his death.
So what happened then? The young men with baseball bats then found him in near this church, St. Cecilia's.
In the parking lot. Well, what apparently happened was these kids ran after the kids from McDonald's to McGarrity's Auto. There was a fight there. The kids then got back into their car and in a caravan continued down and apparently made a hard turn into St. Cecilia's Church, where they apparently saw three kids, Eddie Pollack, his brother, and another boy. And Kevin Convey, who was in the lead car, jumped out of a moving car with a baseball bat and went running after Eddie Pollack. There is some dispute as to exactly what happened there. Convey's story is that he had a bat in his hand, he swung at Eddie Pollack, and that as a consequence, Eddie Pollack arched his back and tripped, spun around, and started to kick with his feet, trying to keep Kevin Convey off him. Convey then says other kids crowded around, took the bat out of his hand, picked Eddie Pollack up, and started to smash him in the head with this baseball bat.
When this car of teenagers pulled into St. Cecilia's churchyard there, Eddie Pollack was walking through, and Convey jumps out of the car. Was there any reason why they targeted Eddie Pollack?
There was absolutely no reason at all. It was clear that the caravan was cruising for kids. They saw these three kids in the parking lot, had no idea who they were. They just happened to be there at the time. They figured they were kids from the rec. That was the recreation center connected to St. Cecilia's Church. And they literally just did a hard turn into that parking lot, and Kevin Convey went running after him. It was because he was there, because he was near the church, and therefore associated with the rec. That was all.
Based on what you then learned in the trial, how did Eddie Pollack die?
He died from blows to the head. There were at least eight. The prosecution says there were probably more, but there were at least eight identifiable blows to the head with an object consistent with a baseball bat. It was brutal. This was one of the worst beatings that Philadelphia police have ever seen. The medical testimony was horrendous. People just left the courtroom crying.
Another part of this story has to do with the 911 system, the emergency system here in Philadelphia. And when these teenagers from a suburban Philadelphia came into Fox Chase, as you said, several carloads of them, many people in the neighborhood called 911.
The calls started as soon as those kids pulled into the Pizza Hut parking lot and ran through McDonald's.
What was the response? There
was no response. The testimony was that a woman working in McDonald's started to call 911. This was at least 40 minutes before Eddie Pollack was beaten. Neighbors called. People were calling 911 saying there are kids with bats running through the neighborhood, and 911 did not respond.
What was their response, though, when they got some of these hysterical phone calls?
The 911 operators were incredibly rude, telling people to, you know, what's your problem? What are you making a big deal about this for? Don't be rude to me. Don't talk to me like that. I mean, obviously, many of these operators were later fired and then forced to be rehired by the city. It has sparked a huge political uproar in the city and created a major investigation into the 911 controversy. It's a system that has been, you know, long disparaged, but nobody's ever done anything until now.
My guest is reporter Bryn Freeman. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to reporter Bryn Freeman. There were some 24 kids that came into the Fox Chase area. Seven of them were arrested. Why were these particular individuals arrested for this particular crime? What had they done that had set them apart from the other kids?
As far as the prosecution is concerned, these were the kids whose roles were significant. These were the actual beaters, the doers, as the prosecution would say. One of the kids planned the fight, one of the kids supplied the weapons, and four of the kids actually hit Eddie Pollack with bats in various parts of his body. What we learned later in the trial from the state star witness, a 19-year-old kid named Kevin Convey, who at the very last minute copped a plea and then testified against his friends, were that there may well have been other kids who hit Eddie Pollack with baseball bats and other people who were clearly culpable, the drivers of the cars. The district attorney's office didn't have that information as they were going into the trial. Now that they have that information, they are reopening their investigation and there may be more arrests.
And what was the impact, would you say, or what was Kevin Convey able to testify to?
I think that Kevin Convey gave and he took away. Kevin Convey was able to draw a very graphic picture of the events of November 11th, a really terrifying picture about kids going out and smoking what they call blunts, you know, marijuana-filled cigars, getting psyched up, talking about going out and beating these kids. He was able to specifically identify the roles of each individual in this. And he was able to tell Eddie Pollack's parents Eddie Pollack's last words.
Which were?
I didn't do anything. But he took away, too. The prosecution was looking for first-degree murder charges. And they had made a deal with Kevin Convey, who was the jury knew would only get third-degree murder, which is a 5 to 20-year sentence, most likely 5 years. And Kevin Convey was an admitted hitter. If it hadn't been for Kevin Convey, Eddie Pollack wouldn't have fallen down in that church parking lot. And it was very clear that the jury felt that if Kevin Convey got that deal, they could not give a harsher sentence to the other kids.
So what was the jury's verdict?
The jury's verdict was very mixed and I think very confusing for a lot of people. Three of the defendants were convicted of third-degree murder. And one other was convicted of voluntary manslaughter, two others of conspiracy to murder. Very minor charges, those conspiracy to murder charges.
And I guess at issue was the question of intent. And that has an impact on what degree of
murder. Well, the question of intent is a fascinating one, really. By law, intent does not mean premeditation, which a lot of people are confused about. Intent does not mean that these kids went out with the intent to kill Eddie Pollack. They didn't know who Eddie Pollack was. They were not necessarily thinking, I think that came out very clearly, that they wanted to go out and kill somebody. Clearly they wanted to go out and beat somebody. Clearly they wanted to go out and have justice, have revenge, you know, right the wrongs of high school students. But the law in Pennsylvania is very clear. Intent can happen in a split second. Intent can be formulated or it can even be inferred if you use a weapon on a vital part of a body. If you take a baseball bat to someone's head, what else could you intend? The prosecutor kept trying to make that case, but he may have delayed it too long. He may have only made that case in his closing arguments as opposed to making that case at every step of the way. And it was clear from the jury afterwards that they said, well, these kids didn't go out and intended to kill them, so how can we find intent to kill? I think in some ways it was clear the jury didn't really understand the judge's instruction. The jury didn't understand that intent is not something you have to go out with. Intent can happen in the moment that you are striking someone.
Kevin Convey was sentenced this week. What was he sentenced to?
He was given, as agreed, 5 to 20 years. Most likely he will spend closer to 5 years.
The Pollack family was very public through this whole situation, through the 911, through the trial itself, and really continued to be outspoken about, I guess, both in making sure that the public understands who their son was, but also talking about the system itself. What impact do you think they've had?
I think that they had a tremendous impact, not clearly on the verdict, although it was clear that many of the jurors felt tremendously guilty about the verdict, felt that they'd let the Pollacks down, wrote them letters, went to visit them, and just were very, very sorrowful that they couldn't give the family what they wanted. But I think in terms of the public perception, more and more we see these families sitting in court, victim who have been so victimized by some kind of violence. And oftentimes the families of the victims tend to shy away from the press, and we can only imagine what they are thinking and what they are feeling. And the Pollacks just put such a human face on this. They never shied away from their grief. They never shied away from their tragedy, but neither were they embittered. And they were able to communicate, I think, and I think it was their goal to show if people knew who they were, they would know who Eddie was.
Well, I thank you very much, Bryn Freeman, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Bryn Freeman is a reporter for the Fox 10 o'clock News in Philadelphia. Throughout the last year and a half since their son Eddie was fatally beaten with baseball bats, Kathy and John Pollack have been a strong presence here in Philadelphia. They attended the trial of the teenagers who were found guilty of their son's murder, counseled young people in their neighborhood, and have spoken very honestly and directly about what this murder has meant to them and their children, Christy, 20, and Billy, 15. We invited them to share some of what they have experienced. I asked John Pollack to describe the day that Eddie died.
That day is sort of like a blur. I mean, there was family that had to be notified. There were just basically funeral arrangements. We had to. This is where it was that day. Ed died around 10:30 in the morning. We got home about 12. Around 2:30, 3 o'clock, one of the neighbors came in and they said, "Somebody has to go over to the church and see what's going on." So, Christy and Bill and myself walked over to the church, and the kids in the neighborhood, the teenagers, young adults, everybody that was aware of it, had gathered where Eddie was beaten. And it literally was right at the steps of the church. That's not an exaggeration. And they were covering over where he had died with flowers. And that's where the realization of what kind of tragedy could follow really struck home. So we talked with everybody for a while.
These were young people
that
had gathered. What were they saying? What did they want to talk about?
Nobody understood what had happened. And Christy and Bill were really the spokespeople. They had a real good rapport, communication with these kids. I mean, they were friends where they knew of each other. And just in talking, they were, they knew what had to be done. I mean, we had briefly talked about it, and they started letting people know that, you know, retaliation wasn't the right thing.
And was there talk of that?
There was very little talk of that. What there was, it was a lot of questions about, what do we do here? And in looking back, we realized that these kids, Ed's friends, they knew the difference between right and wrong at that point. And they were looking to Chris and Bill and our family to say, do you want us to do the right thing? And so it was very easy at that point to begin that. And that's why we spent quite a bit of time that day just talking with people, just trying to get that part of it straightened out.
To make sure that they did the right thing, which, of course, was not to exact any kind of revenge.
Correct. And they really didn't need any convincing. That's the part that is so terrific about this, about these people, that they knew the difference between, here's Ed Pollock died because of revenge for a rumor, and they knew that it wasn't right for them to go and hurt to revenge his death.
What did you need and what did you want? I mean, as it, after his death and then as the story really has unfolded, what did you need from your friends, from your family, from people in the neighborhood, even the larger community around you, John Pollock?
I think the community just filled in whatever gaps was necessary. And that goes for the community as a whole and for individual friends. Everything that was done was a help. People gave us just a whole lot of help. And also they made sure that there was no repercussions from Eddie's death. A lot of people did an awful lot of work to make sure that it wasn't repeated in reverse.
I know, too, that when people have to deal with a tragedy of this magnitude, they often look for answers, for some kind of explanation. Did you do that? Did you find answers, John Pollock?
I've never found an answer. I have no idea why this happened. It just seems like a random event that nobody could plan for and nobody planned on.
Did you look for an answer? Did you try to figure out, you know, why?
We've talked about it many times, both Kathy and myself. We went so far as to write to the Pope and say,
did you?
Yeah, and say, do you have an answer? And basically they said no. They said, you just have to believe in God and trust, and which we do. But there doesn't really seem to be an answer.
So you really sat down and wrote a letter to the Pope? Yes.
Yes, we are. You know, I guess basically as human beings, you strive for answers to everything. And I think the thing that we came away with is there are no answers. We've seen humanity at its worst, but we've also seen the human spirit at its best in the support and the reaching out of our community, of friends, of the community of Philadelphia as a whole who have reached out, and people throughout, even the United States, we've received letters.
My guests are Kathy and John Pollock. Their son, Eddie, was killed in November 1994, beaten to death by a mob of teenagers. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to John and Kathy Pollack. Their son, Eddie Pollack, was murdered in Philadelphia in November 1994.
I think many people, again, there's so many parts of the story that people are struggling to understand, is the fury of the mob. I mean, how a mob can descend on somebody they've never met, who's never done anything to them, and do what they did to your son. To you, Kathy Pollack, do you have any understanding? You've sat through the trial. You've looked at these young men. Do you understand that in any way?
I can't even begin to comprehend such brutality or savagery. It's beyond human comprehension. I look at them. I looked at them for 5 weeks during that trial, and I found myself shaking my head every day. I just couldn't even imagine what type of human being they are to have done this and to sit there the way they did for that trial with no look of remorse, no comprehension on their part of the enormity of the situation that they had even involved themselves or their families in. It's beyond the comprehension of any rational human being.
What would remorse have looked like to you?
I think if they had... They seemed to laugh and joke among themselves, you know, before the jury would come out. They would walk through the halls as though, you know, of the criminal justice system, the ones on bail, as though they had done nothing. You know, it amazed me.
You took notes. You wanted to remember everything?
Yes.
Why?
Because to me, it was very important a week later to have the facts straight in my own mind, because you sit and you listen, and then when you ponder it, if you forgot a little piece of it, suddenly you lost what was being talked about, and you may remember something incorrectly.
What about their parents? I mean, they sat there along with you, I assume on opposite sides of the courtroom. Did you look at them? Were you looking at them for something?
No. We would see each other occasionally. The one man's mother was visibly upset. I mean, if our paths crossed, she would avoid any kind of eye contact. The other parents, there was no interaction whatsoever.
The jury came back with a verdict of third-degree murder. You didn't want that. You wanted first-degree murder.
Yes, I did. I believe if you take someone's life, then you've deprived them and their family of their lives, basically. And you don't have a right to enjoy the liberties that are natural. You should be put away.
Did you want the death penalty? Were you interested in that at all?
No, I was not.
Why not?
I watched Eddie die. To kill someone serves no purpose. I feel that they should be put away. They can do jobs locked away. They can perform services, you know, behind bars somewhere doing some things. But to take another life would not bring Eddie back.
I thought it was interesting and really quite extraordinary what your son said. And I'm going to just read it just because for people that didn't hear this or read this in the newspaper, this was Billy,
yes,
age 15, said, and this was after the verdict, "My brother was the most forgiving person you'll ever meet, and I wouldn't be surprised if he had had a hand saying to the jury, you know, these kids are 16, make them think about what they did, but one day let them go home to their families. That was just the way that Ed was." That must have been the most extraordinary thing to hear that come out of your son's mouth.
I was so devastated after the verdict came in. I could not speak. And we went outside and John did the speaking. And as we were turning to leave, we didn't realize that Bill had been separated and surrounded by the media. I turned to hear him say that. And I expected to see Ed there, and when I all I could do was hold him,
yeah,
and I felt like I was holding Ed,
yeah,
and that was Eddie. And sometimes, as a parent, it does you proud to step back and realize that your children can be better than you are,
hmm,
And they are. And I'm very proud of that fact, because I still wish that they would have spent the rest of their lives. But what Billy said was Eddie. And it was the Eddie that Billy knew and loved.
It's an extraordinary statement.
Yes.
I mean, to come after not only what happened, but sit through this trial and to come to a verdict that, as you say, you are not comfortable with, you didn't want.
Yes.
But here's a 15-year-old
yes.
saying these words.
I think we both agree with him.
Yeah.
All right. Eddie was the type of kid that he really didn't hold a grudge. You know, there, as a parent, you end up in battles with your kids. I mean, they can be angels, but they're still the battles. And some kids pout, and some kids slam doors, and some kids, you know, walk out of the house and come back hours later. Ed's grudge lasted about 10 seconds. You'd have a disagreement, and he'd turn around and go, "All right, you win," and because that was his way. And I'm sure Bill's correct, because we had trusted Ed to give the jury the wisdom, and we may not have agreed what they came out with, but all along we said, "Ed, you give him the intelligence to make the decision," and I guess that's what he did.
Kathy and John Pollock's son, Eddie, was killed in Philadelphia in November 1994. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.